Welcome to episode 42 of season 9 of Move Around Midnight, the Daily Podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the final two Die Hard, the terrible Die Hard movies, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to have to also go through a little bit of torture today and tomorrow is my good friend Alan Sanders of The Alan Sanders Show. So, welcome back this season, Alan. You are my second guest of four who will be making a reappearance in this season because, you know, you were all people who get to talk about both Die Hard 4 and 5. So thank you. Thank you for taking the pleasure with me.
Well, I you know what? If it wasn't for you and what I feel about you and our relationship, I would have probably ducked out of 5, but I was like, oh, I might as well be here for all of it. So. Oh yeah, Die Hard 5.
Okay, well,
that's like
Well, I apologize that you had to waste an hour and 41 minutes rewatching this movie for the show, and then doing research for another 10 minutes of the show of the movie. So I do apologize for that, but I do appreciate it. On the other hand, you know, so because we're just gonna have fun talking about this because there's just so much crazy stuff going on in this movie, and we'll have to try and figure it all out.
Can we affectionately call it the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull of the Die Hard franchise?
Sure, you can.
We're like, it's all spectacle. I see lots of cool spectacle, but there's nothing here.
That's right. Nothing going on. And the story just doesn't make any sense
I told you before we went on the air, and I'll wait till we get to the appropriate place, but I think I know exactly how to describe what happened to make everything go wrong.
All right, I'm looking forward to hearing your opinion on that one, that's for sure. It's going to be very interesting. So today will be a very interesting Friday as we go through another 5 minutes of this movie. So episode 42 begins with John and Jack climbing in the dark, and we will talk so much about the way that they didn't light any of this stuff, but we'll get there. And ends with Yuri happy to hear the work of the masseuse through the telephone. So, you know, we've been talking a hell of a lot about this movie for the last hour and 15 minutes, and now we're just going to continue trudging through it, I guess you can say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, John and Jack are finally got to Chernobyl, and they're finally, going inside of this, the power plant itself, and trying to save Yuri, basically, because that's what they're there for. You know, and so the beginning of this segment is the two of them, going through the basement here. And again, the lighting is just horrendous. It's, you know, you think that even in, I'm aware of the fact that if we were really in this place in Chernobyl right now, it would be pitch dark. I'm completely aware of that. But you'd think that the director and the cinematographer and everyone making this movie would say, hey, wait a second, we want to find some artificial way that seems natural that the viewers can actually watch the movie and really see what's going on as opposed to having to try and guess through.
Yeah, well, thankfully Bruce Willis's head shines in places, so we know which one's which.
That's true. That is very true. But I mean, Jack Courtney's got a very close cropped haircut here. Also, he's not quite John McClane bold, but you're right. You can definitely see the difference.
I will say the one thing that I can give right off the bat that's a positive for this movie versus Die Hard 4, the fact that the guy playing Jack, in this case his son, is a much more realistic and believable action sidekick than we had last movie.
Okay, that's true, because Matt is the he's the computer geek sidekick. He's not the action sidekick.
Right.
So that makes sense.
Well, he's got the right build for it. He's got the right. They give him at least a background in intelligence. Obviously, he's had training. It makes a lot more sense that he could do things. Well, wasted in this movie because it's like, okay, now they've become part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But I mean, he could still. It makes more sense that somebody like him might be in these more impossible situations than the other guy.
Yeah, and whatever the whole idea that John has no clue that his son, you know, he thinks his son's really in trouble throughout this, you know, throughout the beginning mm-hmm. of this movie until he figures out that he's part of the CIA. But it, again, I don't buy it. It's, you know, it just doesn't make any sense, that whole aspect of it. But I guess they had to find some sort of, you know, reason for John to have to come to Russia. So what better reason than to think that your son's in trouble and, you know, he's having drug problems in Russia.
Well, and then here's the other thing you're going to have to deal with, and you may have already talked about it, but when you finally get the reveal that, okay, he's this highly trained CIA operative, but then all of a sudden, here's this guy who's supposed to be, you know, he's in deep undercover in Russia with this whole convoluted story that has so many plot holes, you could drive a lot of the chase scenes through the first Moscow streets through it. You've got the guy who's all of a sudden just out of nowhere, he's unable to prevent his dad, who starts off almost like the bumbling father. Hey, I thought you were in trouble. I'm just here. Can I tag along on your super sensitive secret government mission? Yeah, come on in, Pop. It's all fun. We can do that. It'll be great. I mean, it just, the whole premise was contrived to begin with. I mean, would a real undercover, this guy, deep undercover CIA agent, would you just let even your dad, a civilian, all of a sudden be in there to mess up the operation? Makes no sense. It was like they didn't think this one through to even explain why the two would team up. It defies all logic.
Right. That's true. And we're going to continue with defying logic as we continue through this segment, because then we get a shot of them opening up a case and we see all of the plutonium canisters in there. And Irina's very happy, and Yuri's just looking, you know, a little disheveled on the side. And then Alex shows up and he goes, "What the hell is that?" And then Irina goes, €1 billion worth of enriched uranium. He goes, "What?" And she says, "Don't worry, it's stable in this form." And then he turns to Yuri and he goes, "File." "Irina, cut the crap, please. No one here is speaking about uranium. Where's the file?" And again, the way that I've mentioned this a few times, it's really strange that Alec is also being played here. You know, that this is just a plan between Yuri and Irina that nobody else has any clue about. It's one of the stupidest plans around, because it's based on so many, you know, little points that if any one of those little points goes wrong, Yuri's dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he doesn't have anything there to save him, because Alec doesn't know about this and Alec keeps threatening to kill him. So it's like, well, wait a second. You have this unstable, you know, guy who claims that he's this, you know, he wishes he was a dancer, and all he's doing is, you know, every moment it's possible that he's going to kill Yuri, but, you know, Yuri has a plan to get him, to bring him, you know, to Chernobyl and whatever. It doesn't really make make much sense here.
No,
And
here's the thing, and I wanted to look this up, because technically, now I'm not sure how Chernobyl, which was the old, obviously, nuclear power plant that melted down in the 80s. I don't know how you have these many canisters of just lying around of, I guess it's 235, uranium-235, which is correct. At least they got that correct. Yeah. But the degree to which you would have to have it weaponized versus for power, I guess, are we supposed to assume that Chernobyl was always a secret plant that was actually enriching for nuclear weapons, not just using it for power?
That's what they're trying to show here, yes. The whole point here is that Yuri and Shigarin somehow got all of this this uranium, you know, stored away. In Chernobyl.
Weapons grade. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, weapons grade.
Yeah. It needs to be enriched to 90% to be weapons grade.
Right, but I mean, they just say enriched. They don't talk about the percentage of it or whatever. But, you know, as we all know from recent right. history, you know, you can try and find enriched uranium for other things, too. You know, you don't just need it to make a bomb.
Because, well, well, that's the point, which I know I'm kind of maybe jumping ahead. But the point is, if these are fuel rods meant to just be used in a power plant, then they're not enriched anywhere near enough to be used as a weapon, because you don't need to enrich it that far. So anybody who's enriching it to that point, there's no reason to do it for a power. You do it for a bomb, because you have to have it 90% or more if you're going to use it as a weapon. The second thing is, while uranium-235, you technically can be around it for short periods of time without it really being a problem. Chernobyl itself, until just recently, now this is not when the movie came out, but just recently, you can visit now for short periods of time, but it at the time, I think, of the timeline of the movie, you're still talking about you're already dead from radiation exposure if you've been living in this lair for any period of time.
Right. Okay, but that's also why they had this, you know, the last few days we talked about the fact that they have this this magic powder that they're spraying all over the place that is dissipating.
No. Silly, stupid, sloppy writing. No.
For sure. But that's what they're doing here. I agree with you. It's silly and it's stupid. There's no such thing as
some kind of a pixie dust that you can spread around and suddenly you're not radioactive after decades from the meltdown that took place at Chernobyl.
That's true. I agree. But that's the premise of this movie, that after 35 years we have this pixie dust. Then there you go.
I refuse to participate in the nonsense.
Okay. Again, we're not agreeing with it. We're just stating what they used here. You know, again, very, very sloppy writing. That's what it comes down to. Instead of trying to think of some way out of it by either proving that, okay, there really wasn't a meltdown, it was all a hoax. You know, okay, that I could have bought a little more.
Well, but could you, knowing that it's a real world event? We obviously know it was a true meltdown.
No, but that's right, but I can understand, I can believe that more than believing that they now have created pixie dust in order to make it that it's no longer radioactive within seconds. What? You know, if you have those two options in front of you and you have to choose which one is more plausible, which one is more plausible? The whole thing was a hoax. I think that's more.
No, you know what I would have done? I would have had a scene where people wearing the appropriate gear were pulling the fuel rods out, and that there was a scene where they were looking somewhere else, a separate Chernobyl 2 that had been kept under wraps and nobody knew, it never went online, and they were moving everything to the secret second location so they could still have this whole nuclear lair final whatever set piece.
Okay. I can go with that one.
At least that would have been a little more plausible. And then you throw in the fact that, hey, we're pulling all this uranium, the leftover, now that it's, because it's been abandoned for so long, everyone forgot it's even there because of the danger. We sent a hazmat team in there, and now we're enriching it. We've been slowly working on just something to make it more realistic.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree with you on that. And what's really funny is that Yuri then is taken away by one of the goons. And then we get a shot of Alec saying to Irina, no more games. Where's the file? And then a hand comes from the side of the screen with a gun and just shoots Alec in the head. And then we see that, ooh, the surprise of the movie. It's Yuri. He's really a bad guy. You know, they've never done that in a Die Hard movie ever before. You know.
Well.
And he goes, that's no longer your concern. But Alec can't hear him say that because he's already not worried about radiation poisoning of Chernobyl at that point. But my question then is, okay, Yuri walked off with one of the goons. What happened to that goon? Was the goon part of this plan? Because we don't see him again afterwards. You know, like, how did Yuri get the gun from the goon in order to be able to come back and shoot Alec?
I don't know.
I know. Neither do I. It doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. I guess he just kept walking. He goes, maybe they just had the conversation off screen. Say, okay, thanks, buddy. Give me your gun. You keep going. Go outside and, you know, get ready to do some, I don't know, lift some weights or something for the next scene we have you in.
Maybe he's actually one of their goons. Maybe he's part of our plan. I don't know.
It,
you know, they never really mentioned.
What's wild is even when they go to the long shot to show after this guy decides, after I've plugged somebody from the temple in the side of the head, blowing their brains out of the other side of their head. Great CGI, by the way, to see the digital effect there. He just decides, I'm going to plug him another five times. I mean, just for the fun of it, I guess.
Six.
I couldn't tell if the last one was a pullback and it's the same last shot, but only from the far shot versus a close up. Either way, I'll go with six. So five or six. Like, what the hell are you doing?
And then he just throws the gun. He's like, okay, I don't need it anymore.
It's still half loaded because at the very minimum, you're looking at a 9-shot semi-automatic. I'm not sure the particular gun here.
Exactly.
But you at least have 4 or 5 more rounds in it.
Idiot. Yeah. Yeah, completely.
But even when you look, what I was going to say is when he's plugging him away, that when it goes to the long shot and it shows like in between the crates and everything, the, and you know that last shot is sitting there, there's no indication of where the henchman left. Like it's just, oh, it's just now just the two of them left with the dead body.
That's right. That's right. And then he like sort of barks a little bit as, you know, as being very, very happy. I don't know. I mean, it's a strange reaction to this whole thing. And then he starts talking to Irina in Russian and he goes, my sunshine, you did well. And he says, I told you everything would work out. So again, it's extraneous exposition because we already know that he's part of this. And then he goes, come to Papa. And then she walks towards him. And I got to tell you, it looks very creepy if this is supposed to be father and daughter, the way that she's
looking at him,
you know, coming towards him, the way that she's looking at him, you know, it makes you want to think that they're now going to surprise us that she's not his daughter, you know, or something like that. But they don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it gives a very creepy incestual vibe.
It's
here, which
way creepy. It is the first thing I looked at. Yes. Is like it's like the Harley Quinn movie. It's almost like how like Joker's like Harley Quinn looks at the Joker after the Joker's done something heinous. It's almost like, oh my God, that's so hot. Like I'm so turned on right now. It's just weird.
Yes, I mean, and that works with the Joker and
with a total
Harley
stranger because, who's your girlfriend. You yes, know, not your daughter.
That's right. Exactly. That's what I was gonna say. This just is very, very creepy looking. And again, it adds to the craziness of this movie that there's something going on here that just makes no sense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, again, their whole plan is just completely nuts. That's the bottom line. That you know that the two of them have put this together this
Ooh.
Way.
Ooh, I...
you know, let's break him out of prison, and we'll be able to eventually, you know, get the uranium and make everyone think that we're not really father and daughter. You know, I don't know. And then she says to him, Papa, you're a genius. And he goes, I know. You know, is that like a Han Solo type of I know?
It's so bad. Oh, by the way, the henchman does show back up at the end. I guess I don't know what, to clean up the body, pick up the gun. What's he doing?
Yeah. Maybe he's like, you still got 4 bullets in there. Why are you throwing the gun down?
So here's what's crazy. And unless I'm missing, if his chest, like the as he's walking to the camera, if he's blocking the shot, if you look at where he's standing after he goes, right. And the camera pulls back and now he's going to kind of walk away from the scene. You see the bodyguard or the henchman come in. All right. I don't know if you're backed up and watched it. So the guy's behind him. Mm-hmm. So we establish as he's walking to camera, the henchman's got to be behind him. So between him and his daughter, as he keeps walking to the camera, I never see the henchman stand back up. I don't see where he went again. Where is he?
Yeah.
Where is he? Yeah. Is he just hiding? Is he laying on the floor? Is he making out with the dead body? We do. The guy does the turnaround and boom. I don't know about you, but is it a different hallway? Where is the body? Are we supposed to assume he got dragged away?
The editing is not very clear here, which is also a problem.
I mean, am I missing the dead body? Am I getting the geography wrong here in this room?
No, you're not getting the geography wrong. It somehow just disappears.
It makes no sense. The guy shows up, He crouches. It makes me think at some point there must have been a shot of him pulling the dead body. I don't know why, but then later the dead body's right back where it was because it gets seen. We don't see it here.
Because they don't want us to see it.
Or did the goon just drag him around the corner, sloppily leaving him behind, thinking no one's going to see him, and then that's when John McClane will see him later.
Yeah. Let's hide him on the side. No
one would
be
think to look through all of these open space shelves.
Exactly.
It's bananas, dude. It's actually, you feel yourself getting dumber watching this, trying to convince yourself it's worth watching.
Correct. That's what it comes down to, because it's just baffling. It baffles me that they actually greenlit this movie.
And let me ask you, is what he's...
I mean, they made a lot of money the first week. That's for sure.
It was considered a definite commercial success. I think did they spend like 79, 80 million and it made like over 300?
Yeah. And do you know when it was released? At what part of what time of the year?
I don't remember. Oh, wait. No, I don't remember. February?
Yes, it was Valentine's Day. This is the perfect movie to, for a Valentine's movie.
Oh my God. Let me ask this. I don't want to jump ahead, but I mean, he walks back toward where the body used to be. We don't see the thug. We don't see the body. But then he kicks something, which I assume is the gun, once again reminding us that he threw the gun on the body. Where's the body?
That's right. Yes. makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Oh, goodness.
And then Irina starts talking on a radio, and she says, "Load it up." And then she goes, "Pegasus, do you copy?" And then we see outside that there's a helicopter. Mm-hmm. And we hear some sort of response in Russian, which we don't actually know what it is that they're really saying. But we see the helicopter landing, and then the shot changes, and we see John and Jack starting to get closer to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they encounter two of the goons and easily take
Thank
care
God
of them.
The sound of the helicopter was masking their approach, so that way they could sneak up on them like that.
That's right. And that's important. That's very important. And then we actually get a shot of someone in a hazmat suit, dealing with the plutonium. I mean uranium, because it looks like Doc Brown. It's Doc Brown's little suitcase of plutonium that, he stole from the Libyans.
It's the Libyans!
Run for it, Marty! I'll draw their fire!
So, this guy has to wear a breathing apparatus, because that is the one thing about uranium-235. In powder or aerosol form, that's what will kill you if you breathe it in. The other folks didn't have a problem opening and looking in the container, but this guy is a little bit more cautious about it.
Yeah, which makes sense. I trust me, if it was me, I would be much more cautious.
No, I do think that he wants to be one of those guys that's too cool to put his entire, anti-radiation suit all the way on, just up to his waist, and then, that way he can show his muscles.
Well, because they need to be able to see
it. Yeah, right? you gotta show the guns in the shot. Otherwise,
Yeah. Yeah. And then we get a shot of all the people who are working here. I mean, there are tons of people that Irina apparently brought in, and most of them are wearing some sort of gas mask or something like that, which is, again, shows that possibly Irina and Alec and Yuri were okay with the pixie dust. But apparently none of these guys really believe that the pixie dust is going to work.
Right. Well, and the thing is, like I said, if we're talking about the leftover radiation, the isotopes that were released during the Chernobyl meltdown, there's the gas mask is not there to help you. What's there to help you with is if you're going to be playing around with this weapons grade uranium, which again, you don't want to have the dust get in your lungs. You don't want to inhale it. The very particles, once it embeds in your lungs, you're basically going to die years down the road. So it makes sense that they're all walking around if they're going to be walking with these cases of stuff, but it doesn't make any sense that the other two were opening it up and going, "Look at our new stash," and no problem. I mean, look at this.
What I got.
It's the Illudium P-38 space modulator. I'm going to blow up the Earth.
Thank you, Marvin the Martian.
Marvin the Martian. Well done.
Yeah. And then, John and Jack are just watching all of these guys load everything up. And John goes, that's a lot of hardware just for a file.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this file is the MacGuffin of the movie. It makes no sense whatsoever. The fact that he hid a file in Chernobyl, you know, we just happened to leave it in Chernobyl. I mean, we talked about the other day, you know, how long it takes to get from Moscow to Chernobyl. It takes like 24 hours to drive, and you have to actually also cross a border. So good luck to John and Jack getting there somehow, you know, by following, you know, these bad guys somehow. I don't know.
this is the other thing that drives me nuts about this whole premise of the movie. Especially, you establish the fact that it's a CIA op. You got Jack as undercover, highly trained operative, and they're there because of a file. But no one knows what's in it. No one can tell us what's in it. We just know we need it. So it's really, really super duper important to get. But we never learn about anything. And then only to come to find out at the last minute, there's no file. You guys fell for it. You guys are so silly. I mean, it's as far as a MacGuffin is concerned about, you know, this fake reason why people are having to be in the position they're in. It is so poorly planned and thought out. It makes no sense. Once again, it's pathetically written into the film.
Yes.
I mean, the whole idea makes the entire CIA op feel pointless because there's no explanation as to why the CIA even believed the file had importance or how this guy Komarov is, how they were able to be so easily manipulated by this joker.
That's right.
I've got a piece of paper. I swear to God, it's important. Come on to Moscow. Okay. I mean,
yes. And then we you know, here in Russian, someone says wheels up in 5 minutes. Perfect. And then someone gives Yuri like a walkie-talkie and they go, here you go, sir. Now, I love this because, you know, again, it's a typical Die Hard thing. You have to have a bad guy with a, you know, with a walkie-talkie, you know, that has multiple channels and multiple codes and all that stuff. You know, it wouldn't be a Die Hard movie without that. And then we see Yuri walk over to Alec's body again. You know, now it's returned to where it fell. And he like reaches into his pocket and pulls out a cell phone. And then we hear team extraction completed. She's all yours. Good. And then he takes up the phone, picks up the phone and dials it. And then we get you know, this phone conversation that's gonna last us for the next minute and a half as we finish up this this whole segment. But it's just, you know, it's only here just to give us that extra burst of showing how devious Yuri really is, even though up until now we've had no clue that that's who he is. You know, and you know, so he makes the phone call, and then we hear on the other side, are you inside? And he goes, yes, Victor, I'm inside. And he goes, Yuri? That's pretty good that he can recognize his voice. You know, by that whole thing. And then he goes,
before we get that far, I wanted to call out our shot of Drax, the bearded Russian version of Drax, who's running toward camera in front of all of the cargo, just, I guess, to show us the big, meaty Russian dude running with his shirt off.
Yes. Well, you need him. You know, what good would it be if you didn't have him?
You know, well, of course, but I mean,
he's the one who's telling everyone where they need to go.
Well, yeah. But I mean, you've got you have shots of people wearing gas masks. You got shots of people wearing half radiation suits. This dude's like, no, thank you. I'm going shirtless.
That's right. I think you hit the nail on the head by calling him Drax. He looks like a slimmer Drax.
Yeah. He's just missing all of the body work and everything. But basically, it's like, okay, either that or what's his name in all the Indiana Jones movies? It's like the guy that's always like going to fight Harrison Ford.
That's right. The same guy who dies in three different movies.
Right. You know? It's really bad.
Yes, It really is, because it makes
sense. I just had a little note about my I just want to make a comic version of our version of Drax, but because there's a reason I have this idea of the whole MCU, and I even made a comment earlier about it's like we've joined the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I'll get to it when we finish up all of the dialogue. So now I wanted to insert that real quick.
That's great. And I like the fact that he gets on the helicopter, turns around, and then lifts up his hands to motion that they should close the doors. And it looks like he's trying to use the force by trying to get the doors to close.
Mm-hmm.
And, so then we're back to the phone conversation between Yuri and Shigeru. And Shigeru is really shocked that Yuri's on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that Shigeru's in the middle of getting a massage in a bathhouse.
Yeah.
And you see the guy in the back, preparing stuff and whatever. And then
almost like a steam room, but a real large one.
Right. Because are you surprised? Because I'm in the same place where it all started before you betrayed me. Remember, you promised to give me my life back. You gave it back to me. I thank you for that. And now I'm going to take yours. And, during this whole conversation, we see the guy, the masseuse in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Is a male massage giver a masseuse or a masseur?
I think it's a masseur.
Okay, so we see the masseur, okay, get closer to him and get ready to give him his massage. And during this whole conversation, this guy's just getting closer and closer. And then he starts, rubbing Shigeru's neck while mm-hmm. Shigeru is completely in shock. And then the next thing you know, he just starts choking him. And, he gives him a chokehold and snaps his neck and ends up killing him. Now, again, this is another scene that makes absolutely no sense, because how does the masseur know that this is the time that you're supposed to kill Shigeru?
Right.
Who gave him the green light? How does he know that Shigeru isn't talking with Alec at first? I mean, he's listening to the conversation. He understands the language. That's fine. But
even that, it strains all believability. That it's sloppy writing. They're hoping that the audience goes, oh my gosh, he had somebody on the inside ready to kill him at the right exact moment. Oh my gosh, this guy was so, he had every detail planned. Well, no, there was no phone call. There was no coordination. We don't know who this guy is. It makes absolutely no sense that he would all of a sudden be in this guy, Shigeru's employ, or somewhere that he could get close to this guy that somehow he wouldn't have been vetted from the beginning to make sure that he'd be allowed to be within his, within his inner circle. He's just walking in out of nowhere and starts doing a little, ooh, how you like your shoulders? And now I'm about to kill you, dude.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so bad.
Yes. Terrible, terrible. And then he basically snaps Shigeru's neck. And the way this segment ends is perfectly as, we hear the snap of the neck.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see Yuri's face, who is quite happy that this is what's going on, even though he can only hear what's happening. But he looks like he's in some kind of ecstasy, listening to his, I guess, arch enemy, get killed.
It's like what they just tried to do a few minutes ago when he does the whole, about killing the guy and shooting him like six times. Like all of a sudden we're trying to make him out to be like, he's borderline psychopath. He just gets, he gets such joy out of hearing the people dying or being killed.
Right. Yeah. It's just, again, that it doesn't fit in very well here with the way this whole story is put together.
No.
And thankfully we've now finished another 5 minutes of this movie, that we can move on to the next 5 minutes.
All right, so can I give you some analysis, my thoughts overall, since it's my first time to be on?
I would love to hear your analysis.
We were trying to figure out some of the problems with the last Die Hard movie, and I think they went full on in this one. The charm of the first three, and I think part of what the Die Hard franchise was initially built on, John McClane is supposed to be an average, ordinary guy who's just thrown into some really extraordinary circumstances and every now and then gets really lucky rolling a D20 when he needs to get out of harm's way. But for the most part, this guy, look at the end of the first Die Hard movie. He is on death's doorstep, right? I mean, he has been beat up. He has been shot at. He has been hurt. He jumped out of a window. His foot is hurt. This guy is almost dead. In this movie, we now have a Marvel Cinematic hero. We have a superhero. We have a superhero who's put in such crazy situations. No human being would survive. No one could do it. No one could jump like he's jumped, gone through what he's gone through, do what he's done, and walk around with these little quips like, I'm on vacation. It's like Mel Brooks wanted to make a satirical Die Hard movie and forgot to add the comedy. Like, this is a satire. This is what somebody thinks a Die Hard movie is supposed to be. But in their minds, I want to up the action because I remember how great the action was in the first one. What was good about the first one and the second, and to be honest, the third, is he was still just an ordinary guy. They wrote circumstances around him that are so plausible, you're still okay, even when he just barely survives. But he's always got, by the time he's at the end of the movie, he's either like grimy, bloody, on death's doorstep. This time he's walking around cocky, putting off one-liners and like, no biggie. That's the problem. They wanted to go all superhero and forgot that he's not a superhero. He's an ordinary guy.
Yes. I mean, I've discussed this numerous times. You are completely right. I have the same analysis of the whole thing. That the difference is that's why we have a Die Hard trilogy, because there are three movies where it's an average guy who's dealing with it, and then afterwards they turn him into an action hero. Yep. And it just doesn't work as well. You know, I mean, again, it's always fun watching Bruce Willis, but these aren't Die Hard movies. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. The other problem I have is, we talked about the MacGuffin already, but we have terrible villains. I mean, this is not Alan Rickman. This is not all three of the diehards. I would argue one and three probably a little bit better than two in terms of the overall villains, but there was depth, there was arc, there was a character, there was a sense of you got why you almost in some ways kind of like, wow, I get why we admire them. You know, are they going to pull it off? Had they really thought this through? Look how smart they are. Look how cunning. Look how they planned everything to every detail. You believe it. Here, you're being asked to believe the same thing, but you don't show us anything to make us believe it or swallow it. None of it works.
Exactly.
You've got, like, Komarov and Arena are probably as generic a Russian / Eastern Bloc, just underdeveloped antagonist, just thrown in there. Like, okay, we already had Hans Gruber, we had Simon Gruber, we had the ex-paramilitary. Now let's go across into Russia, you know?
That's right.
It's bad. I mean, the motivation shift, the whole whistleblower turned mastermind is stupid. The plan to steal uranium is as cliched as you get. It's not even, there's not anything clever about the scheme. It's like,
no. Not at all.
The clever part is how the writer decided to make us feel like idiots for being in the theater.
Yeah, more or less. One thing I neglected to mention before, not that it really makes a difference, is that when we first see Chagarin and he gets the phone, he has a female attendant that brings him the phone and takes a drink from him. You know, he was drinking a scotch or whatever it is. Again, it doesn't add anything or subtract anything from the whole way that this whole story is being played out horrendously.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Did you have anything else you wanted to add about these terrible 5 minutes?
No, I think we've done it.
Okay. All right. I agree. Okay. So first we will quickly play the daily game of State Your Motto, where I will give I will name a state, and then I will give you three choices as to what is the real motto of that state. So today we will be doing Minnesota.
Okay.
All right. So you have to try and guess which of these will be Minnesota. So your first choice is Under God, the People Rule. All right. Your second choice is I Long to See What Is Beyond. And your third choice is Mountaineers Are Always Free.
Ooh. Okay. you did this to me last time. You find the weirdest things because the official motto, if I remember correctly, because of where it's located, is it's like the something like the North Star or something about being the something like that, the North Star.
The Star of the North in French. It's L'Étoile du Nord.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I knew it had something to do with like North Star, but okay, the Star of the North. I knew it's also known as the land of 10,000 lakes.
That it is also, but again, that's not the state motto. Under God, the people rule, I long to see beyond, or mountaineers are always free.
Because the Star of the North, I'm going to go with the first one. Under God, we are whatever.
Under God, the people rule. That is incorrect. The answer is, I long to see beyond. What is beyond?
I did not know that.
And now you know it. All right. And now I'm going to do a new segment that I will be doing from now until the end of the season, because all of my guests will be returning guests. So I decided I'm going to do a little trivia game. So I created 35 trivia questions, and every day I will be asking my guest 5 trivia questions, and I'm going to be doing it randomly. So I put it into a random wheel, and I'm going to spin the wheel, and we're going to see what questions. See, I don't know which questions you're going to get. It could be from any of the 5 Die Hard movies.
Please be number 1, 2, or 3. 1, 2, or 3. Okay.
This first one is from Die Hard 1. Okay. Where was Al Powell when he gets the radio call to check out Nakatomi Plaza?
Oh, that's easy. He was actually in the, I guess it was the gas station, but for the most, like a Quickie Mart, where he was picking up Twinkies, saying they were actually for his pregnant wife.
That's right. Excellent. You see, it's, these aren't that hard.
It's Die Hard 1. I watch it at the very least once a year on Christmas Eve. So.
All right. Well, let's see what you're going to get next. So we'll spin the wheel for the second question. And let's see
the wheel of misfortune.
That's right. you got another one from Die Hard 1.
Okay.
All right. What is the nom de plume that Hans uses when he accidentally meets John upstairs?
Clay. Bill Clay.
That's right. William Clay. Bill William Clay.
Yeah, but he never says William. He calls him Bill. He calls him Bill.
But that's right. But how do we know it's William? Because that's what it says on the... It says WM, and that's how WM.
Yep.
That's what he knows to use that. All right. Okay. So let's spin the wheel and see what the next question is going to be. And... Oh, you get one from Die Hard 5.
Oh, that's gonna hurt.
All right, let's see if you know the answer to this one. In Die Hard 5, what did Alec dream of becoming as a child?
Hold on.
And I said it earlier.
Yeah.
when we were talking about it.
You would think I'd remember this.
If you think about the dialogue tomorrow, that's going to come up also.
I need a hint.
I don't know how to give a hint. It's something that he says before he starts kicking John and Jack. Does that help?
Maybe not. Maybe I wasn't paying attention.
Well, think of something that someone will dream of as becoming, while they're a child, that has to do with kicking using your feet.
I honestly don't know. Karate?
No, he says he wants to be a dancer. Dancer.
Oh, yes. Duh.
Okay. All right. That's fine. All right. Let us spin the wheel for your fourth question today. And this time you get a question from Die Hard 4.
What was the cyber hack code?
No. I want to ask questions that there's a possibility you're going to know the answer to. Which of the 4 main characters in the movie doesn't get shot?
Hold on. Let me think. We just rewatched this not that long ago. Obviously John McClane, Holly Han. No.
No, this is Ford.
No, sorry, Die Hard. Right.
Hans is long dead, and Holly is long divorced.
Right. All right. So of them, obviously John's in there. You got Matt Farrell, you got Lucy McLean, and Tom Gabriel.
So which of those three is not doesn't get shot in the movie?
I'm gonna say that it was Gabriel. No. Hold on. No, Lucy.
That's right. Lucy is the one who doesn't get shot. Because right. Matt gets shot in the leg, and right. John shoots through himself and shoots Gabriel at the same time.
Yeah, Lucy.
Exactly. Very good. Excellent. Whew. Okay, and now we will give you your final question for today.
Can it come from the one or two or three, please?
Let's spin the wheel. It really is random. I have no idea what's going to choose. I like this method. You know. Okay, you get a question from Die Hard 3.
Okay.
In Die Hard with a Vengeance, where does Simon place a sniper in order to try and shoot McClane and Zeus?
Oh, the ball field.
Okay. All right. I will give that to you.
Is that you're looking for?
But that's right. No, the answer is it was at the home dugout at Yankee Stadium. But the ball field is good enough.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's because only Zeus shows up. It's not the two of them together. So.
That's right. And they decide to let him live.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, you did very well there. You knew 4 out of 5. The one you didn't know was this movie, and that's fine. That's completely acceptable. And you know,
well, and here
because no one really cares.
I was going to say in my defense, although it's a weak one, I may have seen Die Hard 4 once when it came out in the theater, and then maybe once when it was available for rent. And I think Die Hard 5, I never even saw it in the theater. I can't even remember. I'm pretty sure we just rented it. And I don't know if I watched it all the way through because I was rolling my eyes.
Okay, well, at least you got an opportunity now to rewatch it for me. So yeah. I do appreciate that.
One of the things I can tell you is in prepping for the notes for today's show, I rewatched the trailer. And I remember the trailer. That's probably the best part of Die Hard 5 is putting it to the Ode to Joy mix from the first movie when they've gotten, the bank vault opens and they use that Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. That's probably the best this movie gets is watching the 2.5-minute trailer. The rest, it's all downhill from there.
I completely agree with you on that one. All right, so Alan, would you like to once again this season tell people where they can find Alan Sanders?
Yeah, you can find me, if you'd like, online at The Alan Sanders Show. I don't do movies. I may use movie references a lot, but I do a news talk podcast, political talk, what's going on in the news of the day. If you're interested, give me a try. It's The Alan Sanders Show. You can find it on all the major podcast platforms. And if you want to just follow me, I'm on all the social medias as well. X, Instagram, Gator, Truth Social, Facebook, YouTube, just The Alan Sanders Show.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So, Alan, I hope you're still willing to come back tomorrow for another 5 minutes of torture and agony of
once again going this movie. In deference to our friendship and the fact that I do enjoy, no matter, even as bad as this movie is, it's still fun to talk about it. And I've had fun mocking it, so sure, why not? Let's do it again.
All right, excellent. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Oh, they're red, white, and blue, yeah. but it ain't me. It ain't me. I ain't no fortunate one.